For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. With little to no fanfare, the Senate passes a $7.6 billion budget bill for the coming fiscal year. Because of tax increases and economic recovery, no state agency is facing a budget cut, and many are getting increased allocations. Neva, were you surprised a deal was made without any major pomp from state leaders?
Well, no major pomp, but there's been a lot of... It's been a grueling, arduous process, and I think at the end of it, I mean, what we see is a budget that appropriates nearly $1 billion more than the last two fiscal years, and out of that, of course, from the agency perspective, you had some slight increases where it was possible, and then you had basically flat line on the other, so you didn't have this disruption of the fight over where there were going to be deep cuts. And so I think the takeaway for me is looking now toward the next legislative session with a lot of new faces, as we talked about, is hopefully we will see out of all of these, you know, very difficult circumstances over the last several sessions, that maybe they will go into the next session with a little different point of view on how to really tackle the budget process. And hopefully, the economy and just the brighter prospects of where we are as a state will help enhance that.
Also, very few one-time costs as they've been doing in the few years past. But again, because mostly of these tax increases, do you think maybe that's why lawmakers didn't necessarily want to go in front of media
There's a lesson here. Revenue makes things work better. And so whenever you put more revenue on the table, you're able to do things like fund services. Now, I want to be very clear with our listeners that we're not at the point where we're funding services adequately. I mean, we've gone through a decade plus of cuts. A lot of these agencies that are seeing standstill budgets or increases in their budgets this year, that doesn't even begin to bring them up to where they need to be able to complete their mission for the people of Oklahoma. So we're still a long ways away from that. But if you put new revenue on the table, you're able to do things like not cut the budgets even further than they've already been cut over the last 10 plus years. But if you look at some of the requests that we saw coming into this legislative session, in particular from the Department of Corrections, you're talking, you know, they're not even fractionally on the way to where Director Joe Albaugh needed to get the prison facilities to where they can operate to sustain this huge glut of prisoners that the state of Oklahoma continues to incarcerate.
But let's remember, if you've got an 11% increase in the budget over the previous fiscal year, I mean, that is significant. And I think while we all can say that there are a lot of other issues and a lot of other things that have to be looked at, and certainly where there are needs, as we've talked about, in many of these big agencies to be able to do what needs to be done over the long term, at least we're moving in a positive direction. And I think for that, the lawmakers need to be applauded for their efforts. I mean, we're good at beating them up, and they deserve it many times in terms of the process and the fact that they have had so much gridlock and so much partisan bickering. But in this instance, I think, you know, some very difficult votes were taken, and out of that, we've seen some good results.
Meanwhile, this legislature, which has basically been in session or special session for almost 15 months, is saying they could be done early next week. Do you think this is still a possibility that well, not early next week, by May 4th, which I looked at the calendar and went, wait, that's next week.
That's right.
That's pretty quick. Yeah. That's right, end of next week.
And I think that's surprising a lot of lawmakers right now.
And I think there is, from all indications, a very concerted effort to make that a reality, probably as soon as the end of next week. And I think, frankly, most of what needed to happen in terms of the business they are going to take care of this session is finished, and so it makes sense to move on. Why stay two extra weeks if you don't have to, just because you can? I think these lawmakers, you're right. I mean, they've been going through a long time period here, and it's now time to get back home to the family and folks and the campaign trail.
Do you think you've been there? It's tiring. I know we make fun. Oh, they only work 4 months out of the year.
It's exhausting.
This is exhausting do it basically 15 straight months.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And I think that we hear every year they're going to get out early. I think this year they absolutely probably, I don't want to say absolutely because this is the Oklahoma legislature, but they probably will get out early. I think that if you look in past years when they've said we're going to adjourn early, The reason that they haven't done that's been the budget. The budget's been the holdup. Right. And right. We've got the budget done. And that's, I think, right. Neva's right. This did not happen in a vacuum. And the fact that we moved from 3% to 5% on gross production taxes, that we have new revenue on the table, that is a huge step forward for the state of Oklahoma. And I think that these elections are going to tell us a lot. There's been this narrative, and I think that it persists primarily within the Republican caucus and the Republican majority, that if you raise taxes, if you raise revenue, that it's a death knell at the ballot box. And I think that that's just simply not going to be the case. And hopefully new lawmakers coming in will see that writing on the wall, that they can raise revenue responsibly and still get reelected.
The state house passes a criminal justice reform bill, which was supposed to reduce the number of people in prison. But an amendment by Weatherford Republican Harold Wright in the district attorney's council makes it easier for juveniles to get life in prison without parole. Ryan, it seems like every time lawmakers take a step forward in criminal justice reform, they then take two steps back.
Well, there's just so much to unpack here. Everything from the district attorney's council and their incredibly powerful lobbying effort at the Capitol, their ability to insert language into a bill that has nothing to do with this whatsoever, and it was ultimately ruled germane, but that's really an arbitrary decision by a chair. And this creates this system where we're dealing with life without parole for juveniles, and that's really just children. I mean, let's think about that, putting children behind bars for the rest of their lives. The United States of America is the only country in the world that puts somebody below 18 in prison for the rest of the life, for the rest of their life, for a crime that they commit. And the United States Supreme Court, in a series of decisions over the last 10 years, has made it increasingly difficult for states to do that. Even Justice Scalia, while he was still alive and sitting on the bench during the last decision dealing with juvenile life without parole, said that this decision almost makes it impossible for states to implement this. Representative Emily Virgin had been working on this issue for the last year and working with all the stakeholders at the table, trying to come up with language that would try to bring Oklahoma's juvenile life without parole sentencing scheme into making it consistent with the United States Constitution and these Supreme Court opinions. Ultimately, the district attorneys, when they decided that they didn't like that, they walked away from it and the deal fell apart. And then this shows up on everybody's desk on Friday night, a 14-page amendment that has radical changes to the process, takes the sentencing power away from juries, puts it in the hands of a judge, lowers the evidentiary standard that you need to get a life without parole conviction. These are all problematic, big discussions that need to take place. You can't do that if you drop an amendment out of the middle of nowhere on a Friday, especially when we've got less than a week left or a week left in the legislative session.
Neva, talk about politics makes strange bedfellows. Representative Kevin Calvey joined with the Democrats in opposing this bill.
Absolutely, and I think Ryan is right on this one. I mean, when you're at the end of the session, and what we always seem to find are these very important bills that kind of get crafted, that have gone through a long process, and then all of a sudden we see something like this with a 14-page amendment with a lot of questions raised out of it, but on both sides of the aisle. This was not a partisan deal. This is about, this is about the bigger picture and the overarching picture for Oklahoma about criminal justice reform. And, and Representative Calvey made the point, I mean, look, we're talking about a measure that basically children as young as the age of 13 could be impacted by this change in terms of sentencing and life without parole if this amendment went through as it was outlined. So I think it'll be interesting to see now in the closing days whether this gets put, kind of put on hold, whether it dies for lack of, being able to move back on the Senate side now that it's back in Judiciary and Senator Sykes. I think will, ultimately probably control the outcome of what happens on this bill. And I think they need to be very judicious and very deliberate on what they do. This is a very important measure, and I think the fact that, just as Ryan said, I mean, the constitutional implications and what's already happened on the national scene as well as in other states, I mean, definitely has implications here in Oklahoma, and we should not take that lightly. And I don't think most folks that really engaged and listened to that debate probably went away with more questions than they had answers.
Yeah, even though it was considered germane, could this be even challenged on the single subject rule?
I mean, I think that that's possible. I think
the original one didn't have anything to do with life without parole.
It's also susceptible to constitutional challenges based on the United States Constitution right. and the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. And putting, you know, given what we know about how a child's brain develops and their ability to participate in the criminal justice system, their ability to help their lawyer give them adequate legal counsel, their ability to understand the ramifications of the decisions that they're making, all of these things that we know about the way that a juvenile's brain works. And then if you throw in the racial disparities here as well, you know, we've seen that African-American children are almost twice as likely to get life without parole sentences than non-African-American children. That's simply unacceptable. And so we've got this process that's rife with a lot of problems that are you know, of you know the highest importance. And I think that that's why the Supreme Court has made it difficult, if not impossible, to impose this kind of sentence on a child.
And I think even in the debate, Representative Goodwin, one of the things that she said was that when you use language like permanently incorrigible, what, you know, there's no way to really fully determine that from the legal, you know, from the legal standpoint. Right. She really raised that, particularly with the issue that we're talking about here with children. So I think a lot of things were injected into the debate, and will be it will be fascinating to see what happens on this in the closing stretch.
If they got 1 week left, we'll certainly find out. Governor Fallon says no to allowing Oklahomans to post pictures of their ballots on social media. Fallon vetoed House Bill 3053, saying she was concerned about voter intimidation and propaganda engineering, electioneering. Neva, your thoughts?
Well, it's interesting that since really 2014, there's been a lot of discussion across the nation and states about this issue. And I think there are 15 states right now that address ballot selfies specifically. There are multiple states that certainly address the issue of the right to cast a secret ballot. So I think this is one of the things. I mean, 44 states already have constitutional provisions to guarantee secrecy of the ballot, and there are a lot of issues that come along with that. I mean, when you look at the privacy issue, the anti-disruption to the polling place, the intimidation issue, I mean, there are some serious questions here. So I don't think it's just the idea that someone wants to go in and take a selfie, and that there's no that there are no other issues that come into play here, particularly from the state perspective. So I think it's a big policy issue that at the outset kind of sounds like a no-brainer, and people wonder what the big deal is. But when you really start delving into it, there are a lot more aspects to it.
A supporter said that the reason they wanted to have this bill was so that it would remind people that there's an election going on. Now, technically, there are other ways to remind people that there's an election going on besides showing who you voted for.
Sure, but you know, the Constitution doesn't say you get to choose the best political speech option. Right. It says that there's political speech, and some, you know, we can debate about whether the method that a person's using is the best way to do that or not. But I tend to think that this is a matter of political speech. Now, courts have disagreed with me on that. I think ultimately we'll probably see this go up to circuits in the federal level, and we may even have a circuit split at some point.
Well, it already has. I mean, New Hampshire went to the United States Supreme Court. Came back with, I think, Massachusetts had one. But we've got a real mix on the states. I mean, you've got states that permit it already, like California, Hawaii, Nebraska, Oregon, which has just mail-in ballots. All of their voting is mail-in. Utah was one of the last ones that has done something on the selfies. But then you've got a lot of other states that their restrictions are placed by how far from the polling location or the ballot box that something like that can take place. And, you know, so there are definitely a lot of legal issues at play, constitutional issues, if you want to infuse those. But the bottom line is, I think state by state, they've addressed this and come up with what they believe is the best path. In this instance, the governor looked at the bill and decided to veto it. And I believe it was her first veto of this session.
Yeah, first veto of the session. And, you know, and I think if you look at the states that have done that, they haven't had the issues that the governor mentioned in her veto message. I think, you know, she was very concerned about voter intimidation. We have laws against voter intimidation mm-hmm. in the state of Oklahoma, if there are evidence that it were being used for that. The Oklahoma law on this, I think that you can read it to say that it prohibits selfies, but I think that there's also a reading of the law that, you know, does leave some ambiguity there
for somebody to interpret.
Right, and if somebody
did that, I mean, it would have to go to court to find out whether or not, you know,
it'd likely be a misdemeanor infraction.
It really is the changing world we live in.
Sure.
I mean, the younger voter, clearly this is a much kind of more natural issue. I mean, they take selfies on everything else in their world, so why wouldn't they on this? I mean, I think that's kind of been the thing that has bubbled up.
They take selfies at funerals.
Exactly. But in terms of voter engagement, we have the I voted sticker.
Right.
You have numerous other avenues to make that point without taking, you know, the ballot itself and infusing that into to the whole process.
Exactly. Okay. Let's see. Go to the next one. Oh, hey, this is good. Former Oklahoma Attorney General and now Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt testifies before Congress as criticism grows over his spending. Now, the critics might include fellow Oklahoman Senator Jim Inhofe, who says there should be an investigation into the ethical allegations against Pruitt. Ryan, should Pruitt be concerned about losing such a close ally in Inhofe?
Et tu, Inhofe. I mean, it's this is... That's really, I tell you what, if Jim Inhofe is turning on Scott Pruitt, and I think that, you know, Senator Inhofe he's been a real patron of Scott Pruitt's for a long time. You know, the reports of him flying Scott Pruitt around the state of Oklahoma in Senator Inhofe's plane for campaign visits. You know, he's seen a kindred spirit in particular with the way that Senator Inhofe views environmental issues in the state and nationally and internationally. He's seen a kindred spirit in Scott Pruitt, and for him to begin to have some pause and not just, you know, voicing his unconditional support for Scott Pruitt is a real sea change in the level of support for Scott Pruitt in Washington. I think that once Inhofe is not there as your backstop, I think that Administrator Pruitt is in big trouble. And a lot of it probably is I think in the wake of a New York Times story that dropped last Sunday. I mean, front page, and then you open it up, and it's, you know, two full pages with kind of a cast of who's who in Oklahoma politics, and you read through that, and if you've been involved in Oklahoma politics, you'd probably know 9 out of 10 people that have been mentioned there in that article, and it began to really go into questions about real estate transactions that happened while he was here, some business transactions that happened during his time in the state Senate and as Attorney General. And these questions, I think, have just compounded everything that he's been dealing with in Washington. It's hard to imagine that he survives much longer, but we've said that, you know, for weeks on this program. I think that Senator Inhofe and some of the former staffers from Inhofe's office that have been speaking on the record and some off the record, what they're saying is that Senator Inhofe wants to see this environmental agenda moved forward, and they already have people in the EPA that can do that, and that Scott Pruitt is ultimately just a distraction at this point.
Right, and that's what Inhofe is thinking is like we want to actually do things in the environment EPA. All these questions surrounding Pruitt just kind of actually make everything take a backseat to it.
I think that's right, and I think Ryan is right. There is a definite shift when Senator Inhofe publicly stated that he wanted to look at these accusations. He wanted to see whether they were founded, what the facts are, and then, you know, move forward from there. So that kind of sets a different tone, clearly. And I think Ryan is right. When you have such a major article in a Sunday edition of the New York Times, I mean, it becomes a even bigger national story. And I think what we saw even in the White House with the White House briefing on Monday, I mean, what you heard the press secretary say was basically, look, Secretary or Administrator Pruitt is doing what the administration wants in terms of moving the policies and agenda forward, but we are looking monitoring and looking at what's going on, and you know, we'll keep you posted. So that was that again kind of telegraphed a little bit of a message, an underlying message there that the shift may even be taking place in the White House as well. We'll just have to wait and see. I think the bottom line is these things move much more slowly in terms of a final outcome than all of the press and all of the things that go on, you know, through months or weeks or however long it takes to really kind of get the landscape set for then that final decision to be made. And we saw that even in some of these other appointments or nominations that either have been stalled or derailed for kind of the same process that they've been bedded through.
But for Pruitt, who I think would like to continue his political career in some way or fashion, the longer this takes, it seems like the worse it's going to be for him if he wants to run for governor.
There's no question when you're in political life and you have major stories that continue to unfold, positive or negative. We can take both sides of the coin. It has implications for your political future. So I think it would be undeniable that as this continues to just pile on, and if the veracity of all of these statements being made are held up, it's going to be it's certainly going to have some definite ramifications for Scott Pruitt long term.
Which is why it seems like it would be easier if he just dropped out that way, because he's not going to be in the news anymore if he's
I mean, and that's what you've seen from these other administration officials that have left. When they leave, well, unless they're indicted. And then they're back.
Usually, for the most part, it goes out of
their headlines. Their attorney's offices are raided. I think that, you know, when you leave, and that's something that, you know, Pruitt's in this weird position. I mean, in politics, there's some weird stuff. I mean, very rarely in the private sector is like, man, my career would be so much better if I could get fired today. But his career would have ultimately been better. His political career, I think, would have been better if he'd been fired a month ago. Or if a month ago he and the White House had said, listen, the distractions around
my office. Certainly, if he just stayed as AG and could be running for governor right now.
I think if he'd stayed as AG, he'd be a gubernatorial
candidate. By the same token, we've seen many instances through time where folks that we thought were down for the count came up and had a bright second round or third round or fourth round in their political career. So, you know, I wouldn't say that it ultimately is is going to determine what Scott Pruitt's political future looks like. But certainly for right now, I think the question is for the administration is whether they take a shift and say there's someone else in place, as has been mentioned, that can continue on what they want done. Because ultimately, that's, I think, going to drive the train more than anything else, is they want those policies. They want the rollback of much of what has been done by the previous administration to take place. And if they have to have some hard-nosed guy that is constantly under assault do it, and he can maintain the position and get that done, we'll just have to wait and see.
And don't ever count Scott Pruitt out. This guy is one of the most strategic operatives and operators in politics and in American history today. I mean, this guy is... He's self-made. And, you know, if you look at a lot of these folks, they come from something, right? They've got some sort of a lineage. This guy went from state senator to administrator of the EPA, one of the most trusted advisors to the president of the United States of America. And whatever you think of President Trump, I mean, he's got the ear of the president, and he went from basically nothing to that in a very short period of time. And he's still a young guy. I think that if he escapes this without any sort of indictment or conviction or anything like that from the ethics issues that are going to, you know, continue to roll out for maybe months, if not years after this, I think that he's probably still got a future in politics in Oklahoma.
Meanwhile, another Oklahoman is taking the top job in a federal agency. Now, former Oklahoma Congressman Jim Bridenstine gets welcomed as administrator of the space agency NASA after getting sworn in by Vice President Mike Pence. Aniva, this was a long time coming for Bridenstine.
It was. I mean, this is one of those instances where we've talked about was the nomination dead? Was he going to be able to get the votes? Had it been derailed? And he had a long process. And I think it shows that as they go through the vetting, not only the initial vetting process, but then the process to get Senate confirmation, where they have to really work every single senator and be able to make certain that their questions are answered, their concerns are alleviated. I mean, I think that was what we saw. And then ultimately it came down, as we're seeing with many of these appointments, it came down to a 50-49 vote. So, and I think the regrettable part of kind of this process with the changing of administrations is these log jams that we're seeing, where everything just goes absolutely on hold for so long. I mean, this is an agency that has been without a full-time administrator for more than a year, the interim now getting ready to retire at the end of the month or end of next month. And so it's not good for any major agency of government to have that kind of instability and leadership at the top. We need to have these transitions take place. These folks need to have their opportunity to take the helm and do their job, and then be under the public scrutiny, media scrutiny, to see what they are holding up to. So in this instance, I think for Oklahoma, I mean, we can applaud Jim Bridenstine for being, I believe, the 13th NASA administrator, and an interesting time for NASA. I mean, this is their 60th anniversary as an agency. There are a lot of things going on. Certainly, I think the Trump administration has indicated that they have a real focus on seeing more things directed and happening in that agency, perhaps in a big way, and we'll just see if that happens.
Right.
You know, I'm a space enthusiast. NASA is one of the federal agencies that I have the greatest respect for, and I think that their mission is one of the most important missions that the federal government has embarked upon. Their last 60 years, the results out of that agency have been quite remarkable, and I think that That Neva's right that they're at this transitional moment. There's the burgeoning commercial space industry that they're either competing with or working with, you know, depending on the particular issue of the project and the trajectory of the policy within that within the agency. But you know, I think that it was important that they have stable leadership there, and that was I think the interim director stepping down, I think, is what ultimately put Bridenstine his confirmation that secured it. You know, Senator Rubio out of Florida said, listen, we have to have some leadership there. We can't go from one interim to another interim. We've got to bring this up to a vote. I'm moving my vote to yes. Mm-hmm. And I think Senator Rubio and a lot of the other,
Senator Fleck from Arizona.
The concern being that bringing in an elected official, and this is the first time that we've had an elected official being the administrator of NASA. Bringing in an elected official politicizes the agency in a way that, you know, more than any other agency in government has been largely immune from the polarization that we've seen in American politics as of recent. And I think there's a real legitimate concern that if we polarize NASA, that we've done a real disservice to the progress of science and their mission. Now, Bridenstine, for the last several months during this confirmation process, has said, I will not do that. I will not polarize this. I will not politicize this agency. And now this is where the rubber meets the road. Now, to his credit, over the last several months, you know, he has been studying. He's been going to hearings, to briefings, to everything. He's been showing up as an observer. He hasn't been there to direct or to manage or to vote or do anything else, but he's been there. And it looks like he's taking this job very seriously. And he's trying to make sure that once he was sworn in, that he was up to speed to run NASA. And, you know, even now that the confirmation process is over, you know, I wish him the very best of luck, because we certainly need solid leadership at NASA.
And certainly something we can take pride in.
Absolutely. Huge deal. Yeah, huge deal.
Yeah, tremendous.
And, you know, Scott Pruitt's already called. He wants first class position on one of these, on the next space shuttle mission.
Ryan. I thought you had the first position.
I wish. I've said if I win the lottery, one of the things that I'm going to do is I'm going to, you know, get one of those private space rides up to, you know, I'm going to call Elon Musk up and go up to space. That's what I'm going to do if I win the lottery.
And everything, yes. Yeah. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.